Good morning.
Morning.
And thanks for having me out here this morning. It's a privilege to be with you. A Victorian historian by the name of Fred Gehir tells the story of a fellow named Thomas Hiscock and his household who lived in around Ballarat in the 1850s. And they were regularly visited by one of the first peoples of that place, the Wathaurong people, by the name of King Billy. And they gave him food as he came to visit. And Fred Gehir understands, or it seems that this giving of food was an act of, not of charity, but of recognition of rent paying, recognition that they were living on land that was not their own. And I tell that story because Thomas Hiscock was my great, great, great grandfather. And it's nice to know that one of my ancestors had that kind of relationship with the First Peoples. On the other hand, Thomas Hiscock was the first person to find gold in Buninyong and sparked the Ballarat Gold Rush, and no doubt significantly contributed to the dispossession of the Wathaurong people there. I can see for myself, and historically, I've benefited much by the dispossession of the Wathaurong, the Jarjawarong, where my ancestors dug for gold in places that are now Ballarat and Bendigo. And of course, I've lived all of my life here on Wurundjeri country, where we meet today. So I do want to just pause to acknowledge the First Peoples, and particularly the Wurundjeri people here of the Kulin Nation, and their elders past, present, and emerging. And I paint those pictures not to wallow in sort of guilt, but to recognise my and our collective responsibility to work toward a more just world. So thanks, Doug, for that introduction. My name's Brad. I'm a part of a bunch called Urban Neighbours of Hope, or UNO. Colleen and I have been part of UNO for the last 12 and a half, coming up to 13 years. And for the last 10 of those, we've lived not too far away from here in Broadmeadows. And been living and working in that neighbourhood in a bunch of ways. One of the ways we've engaged in that neighbourhood is through spending a lot of time, which I'll talk a bit more about later, in the immigration detention centre, which is just up the road from our place. Not so much recently, since COVID has made that much more difficult. And the other way we've engaged in the local neighbourhood in our time there, we came to Broadmeadows with young children, 4 and 6. They're a lot bigger than that now. In fact, I'm no longer the tallest, or even the second tallest in our family. but of course they've been involved in the local primary school, and we've been involved through our time there as volunteers, school council members, as volunteer workers, partners with the community hub, and a bunch of ways. And I'll share a little bit more about that later on. I'm not the only person in this room who's been involved in that particular primary school. Margaret, it's nice to see Marg here this morning. Marg and I have worked for a number of years on school council and in homework clubs and a bunch of different ways in that particular primary school in Broadmeadows. Marg, a lot longer than I have. So there you go. It's nice to see you up the back there. For those that don't, but perhaps not as familiar with UNO, like Doug said, is a missional order of the Churches of Christ. And I guess in its early formative period was very much inspired by some of the monastic movements of church history. And it's where that sort of came from. It began in 1993 as a small bunch of youth workers decided that they would move into what they were told was the roughest street in Springvale, and because they sensed that transformation might be more effective and sustained from the inside out, as it were. You know, spread along that southeastern corridor of Melbourne suburbs, Noble Park, where we spent our first 3 years, Dandenong, although those teams are no longer there now. We're in Broadmeadows. We also have teams in Klong Toi, which is the largest slum area in Bangkok, Thailand, as well as a place called Manawatu in South Auckland, Aotearoa, New Zealand, and Waianui Amata, which is in Wellington. So we're a small bunch spread out around the place. What is UNO? UNO, of course, looks very different in Broadmeadows than, for example, it does in Klong Toi, in the slums of Bangkok. But we do share four common commitments. Commitments that we at least hope and seek to live out and hope that shape us in who we are and what we do. And those core commitments are, well, first of all, a commitment to covenant community. That's a commitment to a particular place, a particular neighbourhood, to the people of that place, and to shared rhythms, and a commitment for a particular time period as well. We recognise that change happens as people come to know a sense of welcome and a sense of belonging over time. Second of all, it's a commitment to incarnational presence. And that's a commitment to seeking to live out Jesus' story of being present in difficult places. It recognises that, as with those first youth workers who moved into that street in Springvale, that lasting change often comes from the inside out. We live and work in those neighbourhoods, not only as people who work there, but as neighbours. It's a commitment, thirdly, to voluntary simplicity, a commitment to living in similar ways to our neighbours. Now, there's limits to that, of course. There's many ways. For example, some of our friends in Klong Toi have choices available to them that their neighbours just simply will never have. They have educational opportunities or family and you know, network connections that many others don't have. But it is a commitment to resisting some of the forces around us, forces of rampant consumerism or endless acquisition that are all too often the default mode in our world. And lastly, it's a commitment to kingdom participation, a commitment to participating in what God is already doing. And I want to explore this a lot more with you as we go on today. It's a commitment that recognises that in the places we find ourselves, God is already there. He's already at work. So these four commitments that shape us as UNO are not things that belong to us. They're not things that are even unique to us in any way. In fact, as we look around at so many groups and people and organisations and churches, often we see people doing them much better than we are. But these are four commitments that we name and that we hope do shape us in what we do. So I want to explore with you a little bit more, in a bit more depth, what it is, what this commitment to kingdom participation is. How might we see what God is doing in the neighbourhood, and how might we get in on what God is doing in the neighbourhood? It's a commitment to join in with what God is doing in the neighbourhood. And I want to explore that this morning with you by taking a bit of a dive into the story of Jesus and his disciples and a crowd as they find themselves in the wilderness with nothing to eat. So let's take a look at that story. I'm just going to have a sip of my drink. So the apostles gathered around Jesus and told them all that they had done and taught. They've just returned from being sent out on mission. He said to them, "Come away to a deserted place all by yourselves and rest a while." For many were coming and going, and they had no leisure even to eat. And they went away in the boat to a deserted place by themselves. Now many saw them going and recognized them, and they hurried there on foot from all the towns and arrived ahead of them. We might pause it there. Can we skip a couple of slides forward? So Jesus and his disciples have gone to a lot of Bible translations call a lonely place or a deserted place. Can we skip one more slide? Sorry. Peter's doing an excellent job of trying to read my mind because he's really working on no directions. You're doing well, Peter. and I'll put those last two were probably a couple of red herrings for him. So Jesus and his disciples have gone to what is probably better called, I think, a wilderness place. They've gone to the wilderness. Because often in Mark's gospel, we find this word for wilderness, Erasmus. John the Baptist, we find, goes out into the wilderness to preach. Jesus is sent out into the wilderness in the story of the temptation. And here are Jesus and his disciples again in the wilderness. And it's a place that functions, or a word that functions almost symbolically as distinct from the mainstream places, from the cities, from the places where people are, from the dominant order, if you like, of society. Jesus and his disciples and the crowd are out in this wilderness place. And they find a great crowd there. The word that is used for crowd, a great oklos, is the word here. And that's a word that speaks of the peasant population as distinct from the ruling powers, as distinct from the ruling class. See, in Jesus' world, if you weren't part of the one, perhaps 1 to 5% at the top who held much of the wealth and pretty much all of the power, then you are part of the rest of the 95% of the population who were invariably poor and did it tough, who in their struggle to meet demands of taxation and tithe often had to borrow money and be plunged into debt that would increase with the interest and accrue, and it was a slippery slope of finding yourself in debt, of losing your land, and moving from farmers who owned your own land to perhaps tenant farmers, and then day laborers, and often into slavery and destitution. The oklos was a people who were exploited often. And not only that, but Roman occupying forces controlled much or all of the region. Regions like Galilee, where Jesus and his disciples were controlled through puppet rulers like Herod Antipas. And any resistance, and on a number of occasions we find this in the historical record, any resistance was met with violence. Order was held by the threat of violence. So by and large, all the people who Jesus are with that day, who Jesus lived amongst, ministered amongst, were a dominated and exploited people. So this story in Mark's gospel gives us yet another picture. There's many pictures through the Gospels, of course, of Jesus simply being present with the mistreated and the marginalized. I mentioned before that one of the places we've spent a lot of our time in our neighborhood up the road is the Immigration Detention Center, MITRE. And this is a place where we've simply visited people as a support, as a presence, hopefully as a as some kind of a supportive presence to them. Conversations, having cups of tea, sometimes playing games like Uno or Rummy whatever we find ourselves doing. Often these visits have been just mundane times, sitting, doing something together, sharing cups of tea. But occasionally, these visits have been incredibly profound as stories are shared, as hopes, tears, times of prayer. God is present in marginal spaces. That's not to say that he's not present in other spaces, but this is the mystery of God, of Scripture. A baby born in a feeding trough, a condemned man hanging from a tree, a prophet in the wilderness, two prisoners singing hymns in a jail. God is present on the margins, in the marginal spaces. I wonder where the marginal spaces are in this neighborhood. I wonder, where would Jesus, who is present with those on the margins, be found? So let's continue the story. So it grew late, and his disciples came to him and said, "This is a deserted place, and the hour is now very late. Send them away so that they may go into the surrounding country and villages and buy themselves something to eat." But he answered them, "You give them something to eat." They said to him, "Are we to go and buy 200 denarii worth of bread and give it to them to eat?" And he said to them, "How many loaves have you? Go and see." When they had found out, they said, 5 and 2 fish. So the disciples have come to Jesus. They're worried. It's getting late. The people are hungry. The disciples are looking at the people and seeing what they lack. They're looking at the people and seeing what is wrong with them. They see their deficit. And their solution is to go out and to buy bread and to give it out to the people. Did you notice what Jesus was looking for? He didn't look first at the lack, at the deficit. He looked at what the people had. What gifts and assets are already there amongst the people? This is what Jesus was looking for, and he used those. One of the groups of people that we spent a lot of time with in our time visiting in detention was a particular group of Tamil men who we visited over many years and became really good friends with. These, when we began to visit them, they'd just arrived in MITRE there in Melbourne, and they'd all been, at that time, held in different detention centres around Australia for mostly 3 years. And we would visit them for another 3 or 4, and for a few, they ended up spending 10 years held in immigration detention. Their story was that they'd been told by immigration people that they weren't allowed to be released into the community because they'd been regarded by Australia as security threats. Now, the upshot of their story was that after spending 6, 7 and for some 10 years in detention, they were told, apparently, we got that wrong. You're not a security threat after all, and you can go now. That aside, when we as we got to know these men, we spent hours with them, cups of tea, all of that sort of stuff. And after some years of becoming good friends, of trying of making sometimes poor and sometimes okay efforts at learning Tamil, which there you go, we began to hear conversations that they were having. And their conversations went like something like, what are the things that we can do that might contribute something to life outside of the walls of this detention centre? And some of their answers were, we could ask to be taken to beaches to clean them up, or we could ask to be taken to places where we can plant trees, and they did some of those things. One of their other answers was, we could cook for people, cook for groups. And when myself and another friend who was visiting with me got hold of this, or came across this conversation, we said to them, we have connections with a bunch of different churches all over Melbourne. Why don't you come out with us and cook lunches for them on a Sunday morning? And so we did that at a bunch of different churches around Melbourne. And these were just wonderful times. Difficult because they would come out accompanied by, you know, immigration guards and things, and have to go back at the end of the day. But when they cooked for these groups, there was connection between people who would not normally connect together. They could come out and offer something, and let me tell you, the food was amazing, and be valued for what they could offer. They would come into places where they were welcomed, people who are not used to being treated with welcome. You see, there are assets and gifts, abilities already present in the neighbourhoods around us, waiting to be activated. We need to have eyes to see them. What gifts, I wonder, what assets, what abilities can we see in our neighbourhoods around us as we look not for what's lacking, but for what is already there, what God is already doing? Let's see how our story ends up. So, Jesus ordered them all to get all the people, to sit down in groups on the green grass. So they sat down in groups of hundreds and of 50s, taking the 5 loaves and the 2 fish. He looked up to heaven, blessed and broke the loaves and gave them to his disciples to set before the people. And he divided the 2 fish among them all. And all ate and were filled. And they took up 12 baskets full of broken pieces and of the fish. Those who had eaten the loaves numbered 5,000 men. All ate and were filled. That word for filled carried the sense of people having enough. It's the word that we find in Luke's gospel in the story of Lazarus and the rich man. The rich man feasts, gluttonously. And Lazarus just longs for crumbs so that he might have enough. For people for whom hunger is an everyday reality, this story depicts them having, eating and being satisfied, having enough. It's a picture, if you like, of life as God wants it to be. What in the Hebrew Bible, our Old Testament, calls shalom. A picture of shalom, people having enough. Bible scholars like Walter Brueggemann call this concept shalom the center of the biblical vision. This is what God is about doing in our neighborhoods, in our communities, in our worlds, bringing shalom. And we find all sorts of pictures as we look through the Bible, and particularly the Old Testament, of what shalom might look like. It might look like people living in their own land without the threat of dispossession or invasion or violence. It might look like weapons of war being turned into plowshares to grow food for communities. It might look like people being able to live under, or to sit under the shade of their own fig tree and eat the fruit of their own vine. It might look like children and older people being able to live long and healthy lives. This is what Jesus is about, bringing shalom into the world. One of my favorite spaces in my neighborhood is in the back corner of the primary school where we've spent a lot of our time. This many years ago was a piece of land that we used as a garden to sort of house a project for people seeking employment. And over time, since that project finished up, it had become a place of weeds, as you can see in the picture, run down and neglected. I remember a few 5 years ago, Colleen and I found ourselves on holidays and we began to dream of the next season. And this piece of land was in our conversation, thinking, what could we imagine happening here? Imagine it being a thriving community garden. And to my surprise, when we got back, we actually found that there were other people already having the same kinds of conversations as well. Community hub staff, school staff, our local horticulturalists. And we together began this conversation about what we might make this space into. We began to envision what it could be. And after a few months of working in this place together, of getting all hands on deck, we saw it transformed into a place where a school community could and students could come into. And we have a group that meets weekly on a Thursday and comes in and works in this space. We've had a few disrupted years over COVID, so we're still catching up from that. But it's become a place of belonging, a place of sharing, a place where people can go home with a bunch of produce that they've grown themselves, a place of enough. God is about bringing shalom into the neighborhood. I wonder, as we look around, what ways we can see God's shalom present in the neighborhood. I wonder where it is absent. I wonder who we see around us working towards shalom. Perhaps people in the church, perhaps people outside the church. They may not call it by the same name. They may not have the same stories. When I look around our neighborhood, I see people who are working hard with families who have come from difficult places and bringing restoration there. Shalom. I see people working with young children who have had their own trauma and are helping them to find their place in the world. Shalom. I see people who've worked for the release of people we've known in the detention center. Shalom. Many ways we see shalom around us. The presence on the margins. Partnership based on the gifts and assets of our neighbors. Purpose, three P's, you like that? It's a good little sermon thing. Okay? I come from a Baptist background, so that might be, I don't know, maybe more of a Baptist thing. Purpose, living out God's shalom in the neighborhood. Now, my suspicion is that you can already see ways that these things are happening in your neighborhood. And my prayer is that we might, together, myself included, go deeper in participating in what God is doing in our neighborhood and in the world.